This will be the last time. Here tomorrow.
The first thing is that Michelle has just handed out a revised agenda for the meeting for later today and for tomorrow. Unfortunately, Hans needs to leave mid-morning tomorrow, so he's desperate to be here for wider corporate reporting, so we've rejigged things slightly to achieve those objectives. So revised agenda's in front of you. And now we're going to move on to agenda papers 3, goodwill and impairment, and I believe I'm handing over to Nobu. Yes. You're kicking off?
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. The ASBJ appreciates the opportunity to present papers at this meeting, and we have actually prepared two papers. I'd first like to discuss agenda paper 3A, which is our research paper number 3, and discusses the analyst's views on financial information regarding goodwill. This paper summarizes the results of interviews with 11 prominent analysts in Japan. And the reason why we did this is that in papers for past board meetings, the IASB and the FASB staff had noted that all analysts ignored the amortization amounts, and we decided to verify whether that was true with Japanese analysts who looked at financial statements prepared under Japanese GAAP, which requires goodwill to be amortized, as well as IFRS and US GAAP, which prohibits the amortization of goodwill. We acknowledge that our sample is very small, but our objective was to conduct in-depth interviews to understand how analysts conducted their analyses and not to conduct a survey on which alternative was popular. All analysts we interviewed told us that they added back amortization expenses and impairment losses for their cash flow analysis. And all those analysts told us that they also looked at accounting profit and net asset information. However, some analysts focus more on cash flow information, and other analysts focus more on accounting profit and net asset information. And for those who focus more on cash flow information, tend to think that they were indifferent between amortization and non-amortization. And for those who focus more on accounting profit and net asset information, tend to think that goodwill should be amortized. Based on this research, our takeaway would be that if those who focus more on cash flow information were indifferent, and those who focus more on accounting profit and net asset information supported the amortization of goodwill, standard setters should place significance on the views of analysts who supported the amortization of goodwill. Our second paper, which is Agenda Paper 3, was prepared taking into account the results of these interviews. We start by considering three approaches that would potentially resolve the too little too late issue by accelerating the expensing of the goodwill amount, namely the direct write-off approach, the amortization and impairment approach, and the PH approach. In our view, the amortization and impairment approach is the only approach that is likely to improve the existing requirements. The ASBJ has been consistently advocating the amortization and impairment model, but we understand that stakeholders around the world have opposing and strongly held views on the subsequent accounting for goodwill, and they are concerned about making changes from the existing requirements. Therefore, we are proposing an optional approach whereby an entity can choose as an accounting policy whether to amortize goodwill or not based on what the entity thinks is useful to discharge its accountability responsibilities. We acknowledge that the ISB has been working on eliminating alternatives, and introducing an option may impair comparability. However, IFRS standards include options today that are not as controversial as the amortization of goodwill, and we believe adopting an optional approach would be an improvement to existing standards, provided that the alternatives are made clear. One of the major criticisms to the amortization of goodwill is that the amortization period is arbitrary, and so we did some work in this area. When we conducted the interviews that led to Agenda Paper 3A, we asked analysts about their views on the amortization period, assuming that goodwill was amortized. Those analysts have told us that the amortization period should be based on the management estimate of the period for which the future net cash inflows would increase due to the business combination. Some Japanese constituents were concerned that this principles-based approach may lead to a very long amortization period and suggested that a maximum period with a rebuttable presumption period should be prescribed. Based on the accounting standards issued recently and on the research results of some academic papers, we think 10 years is most likely to be accepted by constituents. With that, I'd like any feedback from ASAP members.
Thank you, Mr. Comments, observations? Come on, you're not awesome. You're so shy. Alberto.
Well, first of all, I wish to congratulate the Japanese colleague because this is an excellent document. Explore the three ways of fitting the subsequent accounting of goodwill. But I disagree with the conclusion of an optional alternative because it impairs comparability and also not clear to me whether this option is on a case-by-case basis or as a accounting policy, which is something that I think need to be explored if we go this route. Of course, the amortization period is an issue. However, I mean, most prepared are already confronted with the estimation of the amortization period. The European directive, which applies to non-quoted companies, requires amortization of goodwill and requires that this amortization is based on the expected benefits deriving from the goodwill. So, I mean, preparers, a number of thousands and thousands of preparers in Europe still have to do this estimate. Therefore, it's hard for me to accept that no amortization of goodwill because it has an indefinite useful life and cannot be predicted when this goodwill start losing value. And on the other hand, people who still have and do an estimation of the amortization period. So I think that this issue is a bit overstated. And if we want to go the route of amortization, permanent amortization, I think that the board should give some indication, some indicators on how to estimate this amortization period, which is, by the way, what we have done. We've given some indicator in Italy when we implemented the directive. We gave some indication, I mean, same that are here. I mean, payback period, extra profit, and blah, 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 indicators to help people to try to reach a reasonable conclusion about the amortization period.
Thank you. EH?
Yes. I just will summarize the feedback from AOHSG member countries. And actually, there was no surprising answers, and there was a rush of feedback. But there are three different questions: whether everybody prefers an optional approach. That's the first one. The second is how to determine amortizing period. And number three is fixed uniform or maximum period necessary for implementation. And about the major question, whether everybody prefers optional approach. Actually, there are mixed opinion, mixed views from respondents, but many and most respondents are very afraid to adopt the optional approach. The primary reason is the comparability. If we adopt that, if we allow the optional approach, it will really impair the comparability. The second reason is, again, it's very difficult to determine the amortization period. So that's the main responses from member countries. And about the amortization period, as you said, it's very difficult for the individual companies and preparers to determine the amortization period. And the third question about the need of uniform period, there are very negative answers in terms of determining the uniform period because it's against the principle-based IFRS. And if I just introduce one interesting comments about the too little, too late issue is that one respondent from Korea said too little, too late issues is mainly an issue of institutional monitoring in each jurisdiction, such as audit quality, the degree of accounting enforcement activities. So this is the feedback from Asian countries. If I add my personal comments on the goodwill amortization, it's a general view. I think goodwill amortization is a very fundamental issue for financial accounting purposes, in the sense that goodwill is a symbol of intangible, actually, overall intangible. And the magnitude and the importance of intangible is really increasing in the market. And even though there are researches and academic studies are being accumulated in the market by like economists, financial accounting has been very conservative and careful in sharing those informations and connecting this information with financial accounting. And I personally believe that I think ISB or all those principal sectors should spend more time and effort in researching and reviewing those analysis and accumulation of knowledge. Thank you.
Patrick?
I would like also to congratulate our Japanese colleagues for their consistent effort on this debate. No, it's fine. When you commit in, which is fine. And by the way, putting this topic on the table on a regular basis, I think it's a healthy exercise anyway. We had a conversation, a discussion in France on this topic. And of course, everybody recognizes that there is no perfect solution. There is no perfect conceptual basis either for amortization or impairment. By the way, this is sometimes a caricature because when you amortize, you still need to impair as well. Which so people thinking that by amortizing you would stop pairing are on the wrong track because they need also to make exactly the same computations. And by the way, the overall feeling is that they prefer to stick with the devil they know rather than to move to the devil they don't know. And therefore avoiding what I would call the pendulum effect. We loved amortization 15 years ago. Now we have impairment and we can criticize impairment. So we're going to love again amortization and in 2030 we will my successor will consider again moving back to impairment. So I think we should be realistic about that. Now we have a few additional remarks. The first one is that the interest of impairment is that you have a healthy exercise to look, you look forward, you're forward looking. Amortization, one of our one of the members of our board said, with amortization you will have a big risk of looking backwards or even feeling comfortable because you do it. You do it on a regular basis, so you don't bother anymore. When at the end of the day, confronting what is sitting on the balance sheet with the future cash flows is a very healthy exercise. So it's a bit philosophical or cultural dimension, but I think it was very, very strong in the minds of the people we talked to. The other remark which was made is that you have initiatives about integrated reporting. People tend to say there is a big disconnect between net assets and market caps. So there is a risk to increase the gap. I know that we will never reconcile the gap, but on the other hand, increasing the gap, is that a good idea? So I respectfully and with a lot of friendship submit this concern to our Japanese colleagues. And as regards the impairment test, I would like to share, and that will be my final remark, 2 points. The first one is that not too long ago, I still was in practice, and my experience over 10 years was that the impairment test was taken more and more seriously every day by audit committees and governance, i.e. in audit committees which I attended, we were spending probably 40% of the time discussing the relevance of the impairment test, the adequacy of a depreciation, blah, 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 etc., of an impairment. So this is, I think, nobody would say that it is not, that it is an exercise that is not taken seriously today. And I see in ISB's agenda, I think also in the US, that there is a real willingness to improve the impairment test. We can discuss the options, but and therefore, for this reason, I think the majority recognizing the difficulty of the problem, the majority is in favor of the stability. Can we imagine introducing such a big change in the current institutional environment? That would be a big discussion. And I think when you are not sure about what that one theory is a lot better than the other one, you probably put the emphasis on stability. Thank you.
Can I ask a question, Patrick? I mean, the observation that you made that impairment, you know, forces that healthy practice of comparing cash flows with, you know, what's on the financial statements. But I mean, why is that specific to goodwill? Because that exercise of looking at future cash flows, is it not common for all the assets on the balance sheet?
Yes.
I mean, why is that only for goodwill? I mean, why is that IAS 36 forces people to do that, which otherwise they wouldn't do it?
No, because it's a sensitive asset. You know, it's of course, it's for cultural reasons, for perception issues, you should do it in theory exactly for all assets. But this one is, of course, the one that is most debated in boards, and therefore people put a lot of attention on it. And because I recognize that having a plant that is useless and an intangible that is producing benefits, you should put as much emphasis on the plant as you would on the intangible. But on the other hand, there is currently a cultural reaction concentrating on intangible, precisely because there is a debate on should we amortize or not. So people say, oh, we want to be on the safe side as regards impairment. I'm not sure I fully answer, but there is no perfect answer to your question.
Daryl. Just a couple of questions, I think, starting with the paper 3A, and I think the analysis here, and perhaps to add to what others have said, I think this is a very useful analysis, and I think it comes out of a jurisdiction where you have, to an extent, both systems operating. So I think that helps us in think about the differences. If I have a look at the analysis that you've got, starting in paragraph 32, I think, which talks about what people see as the benefits of having a mixed amortization impairment type model. And appreciating that's a fairly small sample that you went through, but what you seem to have is a little bit of a mixed view, different people identifying different things. What I thought was interesting is that there was not a lot of commentary in that about the usefulness of the number in itself, but rather what seemed to come through is a usefulness of the information that it provides about management's feeling about the underlying investment at inception. So people are looking at this as telling what kind of payback period you're expecting and that kind of information rather than anything else. The other thing that seemed to come through to me in this analysis was a little bit of a concern about whether impairment still happens too late, which I think is a separate issue we're addressing. But I think that that seemed to talk, and I think the discussion you have about imprudent purchases also seems to be a little bit of an undertone of impairment discussion. So the imprudent, arguably an imprudent purchase should almost immediately give rise to an impairment. And amortization is not necessarily a driver in that space. So I guess the question is, am I interpreting that the feedback that you got was a little bit mixed, and that is not necessarily the number that they use so much, the number itself in the income statement that's useful, so much as the information it provides about the intent and expectations of management with regard to the investment.
I wouldn't say that they didn't look at the number, but I think there were analysts who placed different importance on the numbers. So yes, they were mixed, and difficult to say one way or the other.
Okay, because I guess perhaps my starting point with this would be trying to reconcile why there would be nuances in what we're hearing. And I think what we'd heard up until now is that the amortization number is not doesn't have information content in and of itself. And that's why in reading this, it seems like the information content people are looking for is not necessarily the amortization number, but what it tells me about management's thought at acquisition of the underlying instrument.
Yes, so what we heard consistently was that when analysts see a number that's labeled impairment, they view that as a failure in the investment or the acquisition. And how those users defined failure was different. So was that based on the number after amortization, and so the decrease in the value of goodwill was more than they actually had amortized, or just compare it with the initial amount recognized as goodwill and compare that to whatever the new balance was. And depending on how they looked at what failure meant to them, then they had their preference on whether they would like amortization or not. I think that's the message we got.
The other question I had was just whether there was any discussion about the difference between the benefits of, so amortization over a period that reflects the benefits you expect to receive. So in that case, I might argue that a particular acquisition might have eternal benefits. Just getting a new distribution arm, for example, might have long-term benefits, or was it about understanding the payback period of the investment? How long I expected it would take for it to pay back on its initial investment?
We discussed that, and I think if we talk about payback period and your acquisition was very successful, you would basically write it off in the first year, which was not what users told us that was not useful.
No, then you would indeed keep it on the books for a much longer period, because
if you base it on payback, then and you expect a payback in one period, then arguably I think that, yeah.
Well, but then you do completely counterintuitive thing. The more successful, the quicker the write-off.
Yeah, so I think users did not fully support the payback period or that concept
on that basis.
Never request. Okay, well, since you insist.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for allowing me to jump in. With respect to the Carol's comment, actually that is exactly the problem of this issue. There are people, lots of analysts say they are not looking at the number, but they are only looking at the, you know, whether or not the investment is successful. But I think that is exactly the point. In the new conceptual framework, we are saying that the profit or loss is the primary source of the communication. But if they are not really looking at the profit or loss, that means our financial statement is not very much useful, is not really providing useful information. And of course, the impairment or goodwill issue is a very important, a difficult issue. However, if there are some preparers who knows how long the increased period, increased cash flow period, say for example, for 5 years, we can enjoy the increased period of cash flow. Then if they could amortize it over that same period, it could provide better information to the profit and loss number. So then that might give a better number than just depending on impairment or only method. That is the message the some of the investor or some of the analyst was talking about. I think that makes some sense. If only if the preparer can estimate what is the reasonable period which they can enjoy the increase of the cash flow.
So that possibly is a nice lead into the other question I was going to ask. And having had the discussion with users, it seems to me if I take where Tuck is coming from, and I take the document refers also to thinking about this in the context of other assets that are amortized over life, and people seeing a parallel that might be useful there. That would suggest to me two things. So if I take Tuck's example, if in the first year of a merger, there may be very limited cash flow advantages and they may only flow later. So was there a feeling about two things, either how people felt about straight line amortization or whether they thought amortization should reflect those cash flows? And secondly, whether they thought amortization should be updated as the entity changed its views over time, which would be more in line with perhaps a depreciation type model.
Yes, thank you. As for point, I think we didn't have much discussion about the amortization pattern. It was almost assumed that we would just talk about straight lines, so we didn't get much information about that. On your second point, users also told us that because of the way the standards are structured today, the goodwill is actually becomes mixed with others. So if you make two or more acquisitions in the same CGU, it's difficult to discern where that goodwill actually came from. So if you have more than one, is this goodwill impairment come from this or that? They couldn't distinguish. So if you have a specific only one acquisition and you know about the acquisition, you know how, and maybe you can change the estimate on how that consumption pattern changed, but once it becomes mixed with others, then it will be difficult. So that was kind of the limitations to how the standard is structured today. If the standard were written a different way and saying each acquisition had to be managed differently or something like that, then we might have had other options. But at least under today's GAAP, users would say that there's no way they can find out, so that they just accepted that.
And sorry, just one last question, which I think bounces out of something Alberto said. In terms of thinking about the decision to go with a choice of two different approaches, I think the paper talks a little bit about it being operationally perhaps easier to go for an impairment-only approach as opposed to... Would that be the only reason that you wanted to introduce a choice, or do you think there are circumstances where one option is actually a better representation of the economics than the other?
Well, we, from a conceptual point of view, we believe that amortization is the way to go. But I think our research and other work we did with the even preparers, that they seem to have different views on how they view this failure in the acquisition. And I think that actually made us to think about having an option, tying that to this accountability issue and saying, we believe this acquisition was a failure because we believe this is how we calculate, or this is how we check whether this acquisition was successful or not. And because there were divided views among users as well as preparers, we just thought that entities might have a choice. But then we did have a debate on whether that choice should be made on an acquisition by acquisition basis or as an accounting policy choice by the reporting entity on a consolidated basis. And after extensive discussions, we came to the conclusion that if the objective is to represent the management's view on how they view acquisitions are successful or not, that should be consistent throughout all the acquisitions that that company does, and therefore we came to that that conclusion. But for discussion purposes, I think there is an alternative.
Chris?
So I was just going to comment, pardon me, on the issue about the cash flows and the future benefits. So you indicated that there was concerns about where you've got two acquisitions, how you'd actually measure the benefits. But I think it's more fundamental than that, because surely once you've integrated the new business, it's very hard to work out what would have happened if I hadn't made the acquisition versus what happened because I did make the acquisition. So I just think it's very problematic to try and split out any sort of cash flows to say what's absolutely going to be attributable to the new piece. The other comments I'd just make is that we really haven't heard too many issues in either Australia or New Zealand of people actually pushing to have the amortisation method. We have heard a lot of people struggling with the impairment test, so I think that part of this conversation about how to improve that will be really important, and there certainly would be no support for an option. We moved away from that. So, and if we did go down the track of introducing it, then I absolutely think it has to be principles-based, as Alberto was saying. So we certainly wouldn't want to be introducing some mandatory rules about what that amortisation period would need to be.
Yeah.
Thanks, Hans. Yeah, it was a very interesting paper. So, yeah, I guess as Patrick said, thanks for persisting with this. But, yeah, I think, you know, considering whether or not there should be amortization, again, sharing a lot of what Patrick mentioned, you know, we changed to not amortizing on the basis that it's arbitrary, etc. So if one was to take a purely theoretical approach, you know, I can see from a theoretical approach that it would make sense to amortize over the useful life just like any other asset. But I think, as has been identified, the practical challenges of doing so and implementing something. So while I certainly would support principle-based standard, I'm actually not quite sure how we're ever going to really have something that will be, you know, capable of being applied properly if it is purely principle-based. And then as soon as we're going to have either some arbitrary limits, well, that's probably going to be the period that then gets used. So everything will just be amortized over 10 years. And then you're going to have, you know, entities saying, no, but in our case, we believe that it's longer, so actually this, you know, 10 years doesn't mean anything, etc. So at the end of the day, you know, as much as theoretically there might be some support for amortization, I really can't see that it, you know, it's possible to implement something like that practically. And also don't like the idea of the accounting policy choice. I don't really see on what basis an entity, you know, could argue that, well, both would give relevant information, and, you know, so wouldn't support the accounting policy choice. Just picking up on some of the comments or questions that Daryl was asking and the answers is that, you know, if the information or the benefit of the information from amortizing is to see what management believed would be the payback period or the useful life or whatever, well, you know, again, isn't there a different way of providing that information rather than just having some arbitrary, you know, amortization? And then the other thing that I found very interesting was some of the comments that the analysts made around the impairment being too late, saying that they had incorporated the deterioration of value of goodwill in their analysis before the impairment losses were recognised. And I suppose, well, so, you know, what's their secret, I guess? You know, if they were able to really pick up those things, well, is that not the place we should be looking at in terms of improving the impairment model then? So, you know, on what basis were they able to pick up those things? Fortunately, yeah, not supportive of the choice or amortization.
Andrew?
Thank you. Well, as for the analysts knowing about it already, perhaps that's an example of the confirmatory value of financial statements. But thank you also from us to the ASB for these two very articulate contributions to the debate, and I think the insights from analysts are especially welcome. We've only had an initial discussion in our consultative forum of standard setters and technical expert group on this particular paper, and I think, like most others who've spoken, it's fair to say there isn't all that much support for going down the accounting policy choice routes, certainly if it's a sort of unfettered accounting policy choice rather than a principle that considers the economic characteristics of the goodwill case by case. I think in the latter case, there would certainly be a danger that what was purported to be a principle became a de facto accounting policy choice, depending on whether we can find the right robust principle. So we haven't taken a formal position at EFRAG on whether amortization as a mandatory approach or an optional approach is a good idea, and frankly I don't think we will take a formal position unless the ISB comes forward with a concrete proposal on which we're asked to comment. But right now our proactive focus, we'll talk about this later perhaps, is on ways to improve the one thing I would fully agree with, in all the debates I've been involved in, then views are mixed on the amortization versus impairment issue. So perhaps the arguments are rather finely balanced. I think we'll just question whether the appropriate standard setting response to mixed views is to allow a free choice.
Christine?
So I think one of the reasons why the views are mixed, when I listen just to the discussion and to Nobu saying there is a conceptual basis for amortization and then others saying there is not a conceptual basis for amortization, is that what we really have is a lack of agreement on what the economics of goodwill are. That if you view goodwill as a standalone, indefinite-lived asset, then you're going to be in the camp of saying any amortization of this asset has no conceptual basis. I've got no conceptual basis for determining a time period over which to amortize that asset. On the other hand, if you view goodwill as just an unallocated chunk of cost of the identifiable assets that were acquired, then you're going to be of the camp that says, no, goodwill should be amortized, and maybe we should be amortizing it over the weighted average useful life of the assets that were acquired. Maybe that's how this item should be amortized as a result of its nature. So I really think if, you know, and I would say this to the FASB as well as here, that if we're going to go down the route of trying to take on this question again, we really have to address that fundamental question: what is goodwill? and we got to address that first, because otherwise we're just going to continue to hear these mixed views and not really have an ability to come to a conclusion that we feel comfortable with, because we're not comfortable with the underlying economics of this thing that is called goodwill. So that was one point that I wanted to make. The second point that I wanted to make was that it seemed to me that the proposal is somewhat similar to what was in IAS 22 when it was revised in 1998. It looked like it was quite similar in terms of the recommendation on the time period and the fact that there was a maximum time period. And clearly, the international standards moved away from that. So understanding what worked and didn't work in that environment and how could whatever pitfalls were there could be avoided if you were to go down this path, I think would be instructive. I think the fact that views are mixed is the one reason why you might be able to argue for optionality. So the academic in me is going to say that when we really have a lot of mixed views, maybe we should let the market decide and put them side by side and let them compete in the marketplace for a period of time to see what approach ends up becoming the winner in that competition. And then last but not least, improvements to the impairment task certainly need to be made to reduce cost and complexity, but it is not a panacea. I mean, we have had a qualitative test in the U.S. since 2011, and still we heard from companies that the cost and complexity of computing impairments on goodwill was too burdensome. And as a result, we just recently went through a process to reduce our test from a two-step approach to a one-step approach. And during the discussion, it came out that there hadn't been as much uptake in that qualitative assessment as you might have expected, in part because of pressures the companies felt from auditors and from regulators. So while I think it's a move in the right direction to reduce the cost of doing an impairment test, I'm not sure that that it's going to solve all of the problems. When we went to the one-step test, by the way, we had a hard time as a board coming to consensus on that. We did come to consensus, but it was a 4-3 vote, so it was not a vote that resulted in everybody feeling comfortable with the outcome. And I think that there was some leanings on the board where there was a feeling that at the end of the day, the number really was a meaningless number, and it was really just the event of impairment that was informative to the users of financial statements. And that's how I think some board members got comfortable with saying we could do a one-step test, because the number itself is not an informative figure in the financial statements.
Linda.
Thanks. So I won't reiterate, what's already been said. I would say basically from our jurisdiction, there's not a lot of uptake on the notion of amortization. Given our practices, people have gotten fairly comfortable with the notion of impairment only. They recognize the notion that by the time an impairment is actually reported, that there may be a sense by those who closely follow companies that they're aware in general that things aren't going the way they would like them to go, and that they typically ignore the actual number and focus on the actual impact of the announcement to the future more so than the actual impairment number. And I think that's fairly consistent with what others have said. What we did in terms of looking at the paper, which we thought was a great start in terms of looking at this very objectively, by the way, we enjoyed that, was we took a look at the disclosures that exist over the past few years in Canada with regard to business combinations and what they disclosed with regard to why goodwill happened. So why was there actually goodwill recognized on these business combinations? So we looked at between 2011 and 2015, about 50 separate business combinations. And the disclosures in 48% of the cases identified multiple reasons for why there would be goodwill. And the top three were synergies, which seemed to be a catch-all. Just so you know, depending on how they worded it, it was if they didn't have anything else to say, they said synergies. Which might be a clue about why their goodwill was there. Okay. 38% said revenue growth, and 36% referenced assembled workforce. So there were other reasons
they
beyond that.
They never said to take out a competitor. Which is,
no, they didn't.
60% of the case, yeah, probably the main motivation.
But that's actually an appropriate point, because if you think that management is completely rational when they're doing business combinations, get over it, because they're not.
Right.
because as a preparer, I can tell you that, you know, you said it very elegantly, Christine, about the economic, you know, characteristics. I would say in some cases goodwill is an asset. In some cases, goodwill is a debit. It's a debit because you need to get your books balanced, because it's the difference between what an over-exuberant management group decided to pay for something, including because they, if we don't buy it now, the competitor will buy it, so let's buy it now. So I agree with that, Hans. But anyway, so the point is if you're going to go down the route of trying to figure out the amortization period, then you really do need to think about why the goodwill arose. Because otherwise, if you can't do that, there's no conceptual basis other than saying take 10 years, take 20 years, take 5 years, pick your number. Because analysts are just going to look at the number and discount it because it's not a cash number. And they're going to say, okay, now what does this mean going forward in terms of those factors of why the goodwill arose in the first place? And is this a failure? Is this not a failure? Et cetera. So long story short, interesting paper. We wouldn't necessarily agree that amortization has conceptual merit, but if you're going to continue to pursue this, you may want to explore some of these other avenues in terms of it, because one of the staff said to me, well, if there's more than one factor on why the goodwill arose, does that mean you need to componentize the goodwill and amortize components of it over a different level? And I just said, oh no, don't go there. There you go.
Could I let Raghav go first, because I think he had a follow-up to Linda's comment.
So I mean, if all that the investors are really interested in knowing is the triggers for impairment, like what's gone wrong with the company, that, you know, they can incorporate the inputs into their future cash flow models and all, do they really care about what goodwill number is there on the balance sheet? I mean, if we compare an organic growth company versus a company which is all consolidating by acquisitions, and if all that is important is what has gone wrong, I mean, is there a need for change in the estimates of future cash flows? So I mean, would they be worried about whether there's zero goodwill or whether there's full goodwill or whether it is being amortized or not amortized?
No, I don't think they would. I think what it tells them is a qualitative assessment of management in terms of their behaviors. Meaning, if there's a big number of goodwill, that tells you something about what management wanted to achieve with the acquisition, and they're more concerned about what happens down the road as opposed to whether or not that big number of goodwill gets impaired. So I'm agreeing with you, I think.
So back to the option. I think when the board has tended to think about using an option, it's been when it thinks there are two sets of economic circumstances, but it's not able to identify them precisely enough to really write a targeted prescription, and so it leaves an option and sort of leaves it to the preparers to sort it out for themselves. But the way I read the paper, really, it wasn't talking about that kind of thing. It was talking more about differences in philosophy, which was sort of expressed as the best way to communicate accountability to users. And it seems to me that using that as a driver for an option is quite an odd thing to do in accounting standard, really, because the whole point about accounting standards is to get some comparability between different people, even people who have different philosophies. So it seems to me that's quite a hard route for the board to consider.
Well, I suppose that it's also a sort of a compromise, and that's in practice how we use options as well. But it's not a thing that we want to pursue too much. But as
a last resort, I think.
Andreas?
Thanks, Hans. I think, speaking about comparability, as Christina said, I think there is no comparability to start with, because some companies have grown organically and some have grown inorganically, and you can't compare the two numbers. So whether in subsequent accounting you even further cannot compare, I think to me is just rectifying something that we've screwed up in T1 already. So the question is really, do we need to go back? A question that I had, and I should say I'm not a fan of blunt accounting policies either, unless there is a consensus amongst analysts that they will back out that number anyway. So whether you go method A or method B, they are taking it out. Then I could say, okay, then you take out different numbers. But then the question is, can you reconcile a method A company into becoming a virtual method B company. That's probably the issue. One question I would have is the driving factor that seemed to have given rise to your proposal as to an accounting policy choice seemed to be the companies that have already had acquisitions, minor or bigger ones. My question would be, how would you go about a startup company that does the first acquisition ever? Would you then say free choice, or would you say there's a preferable method in that case? And if so, if we look into the sectors where we see huge amounts of inorganic growth, it's probably in the software industry, so in the service sector. And if I look into that, I think, are we not just creating an even bigger problem over time?
By doing what?
Well, by just providing another option out of the blue.
Okay.
I mean, we currently don't see, quote unquote, the real asset, if there is any. Yeah. Now we grow, and some just wipe it off. Some just say, well, it stays there forever. I mean, what is that telling us as information value? The one strong message that I always get from our preparer community is, there seems to be a strong consensus nobody is using the impairment test numbers. So if we believe that management is managing the company based on the impairment test, it's not. Because the impairment test is derived from accounting conventions that do not always, or I would say rarely ever, resonate with the rationale how management believes they have made a successful acquisition or not. So there are different factors. But as long as the user community believes that the impairment test is the yardstick against which to judge whether an investment was a successful one or not, was a failure or not, I think we've always had a discrepancy. It's very hard to reconcile, and I don't know how to do it.
But I must say, I think the comparability argument is the most persuasive argument in favor of amortization. It's a company that grows organically and tries to achieve expansion or an intangible probably expenses most of those costs. And a company that acquires has this immediate capital outlay, part of it's reflected in goodwill, and if that goodwill would be amortized, then they would also increase their expenses level.
There's other layers of comparability too, right? Because we don't allow internally generated goodwill to be capitalized either. So there's more to that comparability.
So that's what I meant with we screwed it up in T1. So we don't recognize the self-generator things, at least not holistically.
So amortization would do a little bit to address the redressing.
Yeah.
That's the most powerful argument. The problem is how to do it in a proper way.
Depends which way you think it's addressing it. It depends whether you think it's fundamentally right to not have those assets on your balance sheet, or whether it's actually, as Andreas said, fundamentally wrong not to have them there in the start.
Well, yes, okay, but obviously we're not going to get there, and that would, you know, it means that the organically growing companies have a sort of a accounting disadvantage relative to those who do it by acquisition. That's what bothers me most about the present situation, and I don't think we're going to solve that by putting all intangibles on the balance sheet. That's not going to happen. Chang Wu.
Thank you. Double. This is a really excellent paper on discussing all important issues on this goodwill and amortization. But based on Christine's very good summary of the issue, fundamentally, conceptually, which view are you for among these two? The indefinitely in life intangibles or some kind of a cost accumulated like a PP&E, for example. Which asset do you think is this goodwill be?
We don't have it in the paper, but I think our view is that goodwill is a wasting asset or decreases in value at some point of time.
You are in the second camp of the Christians, right? Based on your analysis, very excellent analysis here, in paragraph 20, you said a kind of a matching concept. So that matching concept might be consistent with the latter part of the group. of their consumption of the some kind of asset. However, in paragraph 10, you said there are a kind of a different concept of the change of the value of goodwill. That's a kind of competition might deteriorate the value of goodwill. So it's another concept of the changing the value of a goodwill. So basically, as Christian said, we need to maybe a kind of describe precisely what goodwill is actually, whether it's consumable or not. There are many factors affect the value of a goodwill. We are just showing the balance of goodwill on the balance sheet. Others are going to the income statement, something else. So that's our purpose of this this accounting. So I think if you go further into that the analysis of the what the nature of goodwill, and actually our definition of goodwill is different. A kind of a remaining balances of all everything. There are many components of their goodwill, not just pure goodwill at all. So we need to more practical analysis of this issue based on the Christine's suggestion, whether there is some kind of consumable part of this goodwill in IFRS 3 or not. So, components by components, you can make a more concrete advice to us. Then we may think some part of the, if we take a component approach, then maybe we can adapt a amortization because that part is a consumable asset. Others, there's another issue whether that's indefinite life asset or not. So this kind of a more further analysis might really be really helpful for our staff and our board members to think more carefully whether this amortization. However, this might not be easy, but you have been spent a lot of time and a lot of resources in exploring this idea. So I'm very I would like to have you have a good
food. Some more.
Okay.
Please.
Can I ask a question, though, just to follow up on Christine's part? Because I wondered whether the paper was even a slightly different articulation of your view, because if I understood what you said correctly, you said that if you think that goodwill is sort of a standalone asset in its own right, with an indefinite life, because of the indefinite life you wouldn't amortize it, so I understand that. And the alternative was that it was, and I can't remember exactly how you expressed it, but that it was an unallocated amount that wasn't really a standalone asset in its own right, and so you might look at the weighted average life of the other assets that you'd acquire and use that as the basis for the amortization. Is that correct? Whereas I think that what was suggested from the analyst feedback was that it sort of was a thing in its own right, but it didn't last forever. And so you were thinking about the value that would be generated from the asset over a period of time, and that would be the basis for the amortization. So the amortization wasn't driven so much by the other identifiable assets that you could see in their weighted average life. It was thinking about goodwill as a source of value of a different nature, so which is sort of in between the two a little bit, I think, because Christine's not saying it's a standalone asset that's got an infinite life. Yeah. Is that fair, Christine?
Yeah, I think that is fair, and that's why I think it's really important to get very explicit on what the economics of that item is, because then it does feed into the other aspects with respect to impairment even. When we talk about some of the users said, well, impairment relative to the original amount tells me that it was a failed acquisition. Well, if you believe that goodwill is a standalone, indefinite-lived asset, then you would want to compare the current value to what you originally paid for that asset. And if it was less, you'd say, I had a failure. Yeah. On the other hand, if you view the goodwill as a portion of cost that we just couldn't allocate to the underlying assets, then you'd want to be writing that off, and you would only have an impaired an impairment that would signal a failure if you had to write goodwill down below the amount that you had been, you know, the amortized amount that is left, or the unamortized amount that is left. So it really impacts every piece of what's in your paper, and you can see the users are as split in how they view the nature of goodwill as we are. And I think that's, you know, when you don't understand the economics of the thing you're trying to account for, it makes it very hard to account.
But in your thinking, this idea of amortizing based on how long you think you're going to generate additional cash because of the acquisition, which is the sort of idea as I understood it, where does that fit?
So I would say that that probably is somewhat in between. I tend to think about it more as a fundamentally an unallocated cost of the identifiable assets that you acquired. But
then there are also people like Kim who say, well, basically it is a wasting asset, but I don't know how to waste it. So
I know how to waste it. In my world, I wouldn't know how to waste it.
It's not waste time. It's not waste time trying to figure out.
Yeah.
I don't know which bin to put it in.
Yeah.
It's not only it's wasting, it's a replenishing asset.
And Alexandru.
Nobu, in your first paper, you mentioned direct write-off of goodwill.
Yes.
But then in the second paper on the analysts, it's not mentioned. So my question is, did any of the analysts reference this? Is there any support for that? Because to answer Hans's comment earlier about comparability, I don't think amortization does produce comparability. I think direct write-off produces the only real comparability that you can get in this area.
There was one analyst who actually did mention that direct write-off would make their analysis very easy in terms of comparability, I think. But that analyst didn't go far enough to explain why, but he did mention the possibility.
Did that analyst mention what disclosures, what information, supplementary information they would like if there was direct write-off? Because clearly you don't want to just lose the information about what was spent, and that some sort of disclosure or analysis would be necessary, I guess. So did they mention that?
What I recall is that he did think that that was theoretically one possible, but he just didn't think that that was possible in terms of standard setting and convincing the rest of the world, and he didn't go far enough to explain. So maybe we can talk to that analyst again and see what he thinks, but we didn't go far enough in the conversation.
Alexander.
Well, it's very hard to say something about goodwill because it's been around for 300 years and we haven't found it. There's mention of goodwill in the 17th century, so it's among the most controversial topics. But one thing that I may help in your research is that at least people that I talk to tend to see impairment versus amortization as a discussion. And I don't believe that's the case, because impairment and amortization are solutions to different questions. So even if you have amortization, you continue to have impairment. But some people say, well, let's not impair this. Let's not amortize this for 40 years, because at the end of the day, we're going to have a useless asset. So, and they seem to think that impairment is important because you can act on a more timely basis. So maybe some people are arguing in favor of impairment because they believe that if they go to amortization, they're going to lose impairment, which is obviously, I don't believe the case. Another more practical problem here is, well, I agree with Stephen that the way to make it comparable is to write down immediately. And some people that I talk to, favor that option. And there is another problem that I believe it's worth asking people. It's, well, there's a time issue here that's very important. Okay, when you do a business plan, you do a valuation, you found some justification for a goodwill at the moment, maybe cost that I don't know how to allocate, maybe there is value here somewhere, etc. Well, but it's hard to make this rationale 10 years after that.
Because, well, where is the synergy if the product that may you bought some, you acquired some time ago, they don't exist anymore, or they've been modified? So the rationale for having goodwill 10 years, sometimes David used to have the John Walker example, which is a single brand and a single company that produced more or less the same, well, we like to have the same product over 200 years. Well, but most companies do not work that way. So it's very hard after 10 years, I mean, from a very practical point of view, to organize how that goodwill exists looking to the future, because the company changed completely.
We have to move on to the next presentation. But Tom,
so I believe those topics should be included in the conversation because they're very practical and important.
Thank you. Okay, so just back to the what is it, I have a question. A lot of people, it's a more general question, but first to the preparers of the report. Because a lot of people have talked about it being indefinite life that you can't specify and therefore hard to amortize. And I think there was a doc, one of the standards ages ago said indefinite but not infinite. And I think that's still true. And I guess my question is, a lot of people, some of the discussion said there's value in the impairment because it signals failure. But if it's a wasting asset, you'll eventually have to impair it simply because it's wasted. You haven't failed. It's simply wasted. Mm-hmm. And so my question is, did any of the analysts sort of think about that, or do you guys have a view on impairment qua failure versus impairment qua wasting asset?
So the users are telling us that if the value of the asset becomes lower than any amortization pattern, that then that is when a failure is recognized. And I think that may be a little bit different from IFRS because Japanese GAAP uses more or less a fixed number than just amortize or depreciate based on the useful life. But I don't see a difference between other wasting assets and goodwill in that sense. I'm not sure if I'm answering your question right, but it will depend on the initial expectations versus the actual result, and if there is a downward adjustment that needs to be made, that's when the impairment is recognized.
Okay. Raghava.
Thank you, Hans. So agenda paper 3B has four sections, but in the interest of the time, I'll skip section 1, which is only providing an overview of the research project, the objectives of the research project, and the feedback that led to the research project. Now, the second section from page 12 to page 16 is providing a summary of the feedback that we received in the past from consultative groups. That includes you. We have a question on it, but in the interest of time, I would want to skip that totally and go to the third section from page 18 to page 22, which explains one of the possible approaches that we think might improve the effectiveness of the impairment test, which is to use a single method, either a fair value less cost of disposal or a VRU, as the sole basis for determining the recoverable amount. Our main considerations are set out on pages 20 and 21. And with that, I have the question for you on page 22 and open up the discussion on using a single method.
Yes,
thank you. When we get into this kind of discussion, we would like the ISP to be consistent in how to treat the impairment of goodwill and the impairment of other assets like PP&E. I think IAS 36 covers goodwill as well as other assets, and I think the ISP should be consistent in that sense. And therefore, we don't have a clear view on whether FVLCD or VIU is better, but we don't want this discussion to be limited to goodwill, but rather cover all the assets that are under IS 36.
Andrew?
Thank you. FRAG's just issued a discussion paper of our own at the end of June, open for comments till the end of the year, which sets out some suggestions and thoughts on how the goodwill impairment test might be improved, and the broad objectives, the two objectives of reducing complexity and potentially improving robustness are the same, and indeed the detailed suggestions are really quite similar, arrived at independently, but thus far we're in kind of similar places. I've just emphasised these are very much ideas we want to expose to gather input in due course to provide input into the ISB's ongoing work, not ideas we're at this stage saying are necessarily ones to be pursued. But one of them is indeed looking at whether we could go for a single measurement instead of two. On that point, one of the questions in your presentation is whether most of the time they come out with materially different numbers, and in our very limited evidence so far, just based on anecdotal evidence, I would say I suggest most of the time not, but sometimes yes. And in terms of those sometimes yes, sometimes because of the prohibition on including the effects of restructuring within the VIU cash flows. So that's another idea, and perhaps if progress was made in that area, the extent of differences would be reduced still further. In terms of which measurement is preferable, we don't express even a tentative view on this point, but I was intrigued by the comments from the CFA Institute, who know more about valuation than I would, but is a level 3 fair value, and that's generally what we're dealing with in reality? Is that actually much more objective than a value and use calculation that maximises the use of certain observable inputs? I think that's a question which I perhaps want to put back to those who are saying that the fair value approach is somehow more objective. And I'd also observe that if you actually plan to sell the asset within the detailed forecasting period, then the estimated sale proceeds will be part of the cash flows brought into the value in use calculation. And if the probability of sale reaches the appropriate threshold, of course, you'll flip into IFRS 5. So, purely as a personal suggestion, I think value in use would be a better reflection of the way the assets are actually plan to be used in the business, so would support it on that basis, but that's just a personal observation, not a formal FRAG view.
Chris?
So we're certainly supportive of trying to find a single methodology. I guess we would have had some different views about the impact of fair value versus VIU in Australia. It's actually created some quite significant differences, particularly around companies in the mining industry. They tend to have to go to fair value because they are looking out and looking at phase 2, 3, 4 of developing their assets. And so doing a VIU restricted solely to the first phase sometimes is just not going to give them the right answer. So I guess the way we think of it is that both fair value and VIU are cash flow methodologies, and fair value is trying to look at what a market participant would have as assumptions. And so if you started with that, but then said there may be circumstances where a VIU method of assumptions was actually more appropriate, and then you could clearly articulate why that was the case, that using the same fundamental methodology might be a better way of approaching it. So it's one methodology, but you might just have different assumptions that are going into that methodology. And just picking up on a couple of the other issues, we'd certainly agree that the tax issue is the thing that absolutely everybody does not understand and nobody can articulate. So anything you could do in that space would be particularly helpful. But it's basically just getting back to what are you really trying to measure, and I think it all ties into what's the best methodology for that.
Patrick?
Just a quick word to say that when we have discussed this paper, there is no huge support to the restriction to one methodology. people prefer to retain two, because one is adapted in certain cases, the other one in other cases, and disclosure is okay. And as regards the annual test, people feel that it's a healthy exercise which should be continued anyway, because that's a rendezvous point to consider.
Alberto? I'm in favor of reducing the test to one methodology, and I would say that the one which better reflects the way the business is managed is the value in use, because saying that I might sell something means I'm cutting my heart. A good entrepreneur would continue to use the best way its asset, unless exceptional circumstances. On the discount rate, I would be in favor of going to the post-tax rate, because this is what normally the analysts do when they assess the value of a business. They use the post-tax rate, not the pre-tax. And the annual test, I think, should be retained, because especially if we talk about goodwill, going back to the research done by the Japanese, there are a lot of companies where goodwill amounts to more than 50% of the tangible assets. So it's a delicate or sensitive number. And therefore, I would favor it to continue an annual test. Also because of the matter of governance. I mean, it's good governance in the sense that to do this calculation, you need to the board needs to project 5 years from now, and so they really force the board members to look at what could be the business, how the business could develop. This is good governance. In Italy, our regulators has issued regulation whereby the board must approve the 5 years plan and the key elements of the impairment test in a board meeting before the approval of the annual statement, the financial statement, so that the impairment test is not just one of the main disclosure in the financial statement. It's something on which the board must take responsibility. So there are also this behavioral aspect in retaining the annual impairment of indefinite life assets.
Patrick, you want to...
Just a quick word on restricting to one of the two and choosing VIU. I think we need to be careful, because I have vivid memories of cases where discussion was revolving on the VIU, and there was it was close to impairment, when in fact the decision was taken to sell, and the sale brought a lot more than the intangible sitting on the balance sheet. So that's personal experience. Therefore, I think we need to be careful, and people can explain why they would choose VIU rather than fair value less cost of disposal. So sorry to get back, but I wanted to reflect on personal experience on this topic.
How could we word this? I mean, value in use unless there is a plan to dispose of the asset.
Or a possibility. Which is a bit different.
I was texting to plan, not to possibility, because otherwise...
Hey, you know, you value your options.
Andrew, you want to get back in?
Yeah, just to follow up on a couple of points that I raised. On the discount rate and the pre- or post-tax question, that's another issue in the FRAC paper, of course, a much debated topic, and I would certainly agree that the guidance in BCZ something of IS 36 on how to derive the pre-tax rate from the post-tax rate, is, well, I've read a number of times, and one time I understood it. It's not. I'm not quite sure how rigorously the suggested iterative approach in that context is followed in practice. But the devil's in the detail. In terms of moving to a post-tax rate approach, if you nonetheless are expected to allocate tax cash flows, determine the timing of those cash flows at the level of the unit of account for impairment, the CG or whatever, is that actually going to end up being a lot simpler? One could question that. Whereas if you simply said, well, as a practical expedience, you're allowed to gross up the pre-tax rate, post-tax rate to a pre-tax rate, unless there are particular circumstances to indicate that's going to give you a materially wrong answer. That might be a genuine simplification, but I don't think it's quite as simple as just saying you can flip to post-tax rate. And on the point I was going to raise, I think that's actually probably it.
Raghava, why don't you move on?
So, moving on to the fourth section of the paper from page 23 to page 27, that section explains a possible simplification. I think Albert already commented on that. So, which is to remove the requirement to perform the quantitative test if there are no indicators of possible impairment. Now, on page 23, we've set out varying degrees of relief that could be considered, with the consequences of providing relief set out on page 25. With that, I have the questions to you on page 27.
Well, Patrick and Alberto have already said no relief, right? Yeah. Andrew.
This is another suggestion that's in the FRAG paper, just to generate debate. So in terms of should you consider it, we'd say yes, you should look into it further. The approach we actually put in the FRAG paper is more around requiring preparers to establish a sort of level of probability, a level of confidence that there is no impairment. So it's not quite the same as here. We haven't really considered the question as to whether it should be a sort of time limited or the relief should only kick in after a certain number of years. I can sort of see the argument to at least require a quantitative impairment test in the first year after acquisition to weed out the most over-exuberant levels of payment, perhaps. But I think we're looking at some related issues, and there could be some combination which could be a meaningful simplification.
I mean, just to add to your comment, I think what we've heard from some preparers at the recent CMAG-CTF meeting is that shortly after an acquisition, I don't think any company would accept that there is an impairment, especially if circumstances do not change much. So I think their feedback was, like, even if we require a mandatory quantitative test for the first few years after the acquisition, I mean, their feedback is that probably nobody would accept there's an impairment, especially if there's not much change in the circumstances between, you know,
change of management.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, change of management is a different question, but I mean, with management remaining the same.
When you say they wouldn't accept there's an impairment, yeah. It's not it's not a choice, is it? To me, if you don't want. The numbers might turn out to not have an impairment, but
if there's no much change in the circumstances, they think that even a calculation wouldn't bring out an impairment.
The calculation's wrong.
Okay. Well, the calculation would prove that or not, I guess.
Christine?
So I was just going to reiterate that our experience has been that with Approach 1 in existence since 2011, it appears that there are other frictions that stop companies from even doing that. But I was going to comment on the indicators, because you had a question about the indicators. And when I go through and compare the indicators that are currently in IAS 36 to the ones that are in the FASB standard,
There is one that is more of a non-financial indicator, that being other relevant entity-specific events like a change in management, a change in strategy, or litigation that is taking place. So that might be one to consider if you are interested in adding a non-financial indicator. And then another financial indicator that is included in our list is a sustained decrease in the share price. And I didn't quite see that as fitting into any of those that were currently listed. But again, I'm not sure how much use they actually get anyway.
There is. In the current standard, the decline in share price is there.
Maybe
you haven't picked up in this summary, but there is already.
Oh, it is. Okay.
It's just that the indicators in IAS 36 are probably described at a 30,000 feet level, whereas the past the ASU, it's more like at a 10,000 feet level. So, I mean, it's like all indicators in the past B's ASU would fit into one or the other in the IAS 36 indicators.
Okay. But these are examples. I think there's danger in trying to sort of dress up examples as an exhaust. The more you put in there, the more it starts to look like it's an exhaustive list and becomes a checklist. So maybe less is more.
Okay.
That's it.
So we seem to be going behind, but now we're ahead of schedule. So I'm sorry if I cut anybody short. Let's reconvene at 1 o'clock.